I try to give people some alternatives. What might happen if you're treated? What might happen if you're not treated? How much time you have to make this decision? And what you can do after you leave the emergency department. But it all takes time. And people are waiting. And as some people, as the patient in front of you gets better, someone even sicker is being brought in the back door.
How can we change the way we think about difficult patients? Let's talk all about it with author, speaker, and board-certified emergency physician Joan Nadorf, right here on episode 467 of The Nurse Keith Show. Well, hello there. This is Nurse Keith. This podcast is always about you and your personal professional development, your career, and the healthcare system writ large. And I'm here to share education, ideas, diatribes, and informative interviews with some of the most inspiring and interesting people from the worlds of healthcare, nursing, medicine, entrepreneurship, and beyond. I love having you along for the ride, and I thank you from the bottom of my nurse podcaster's heart for being part of the growing Nurse Keith Nation. If you'd like to help other people find the show, of course you can honor my ubiquitous request to leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts or on Google, Amazon, or Spotify, or just share the show with anyone who you think might enjoy it or get something out of it. And if you'd like to become a patron, I would love for you to go to patreon.com, patreon.com/Nurse Keith. Patrons give as little as $2 a month to support the show and to pay a little bit towards the upkeep of making sure the Nurse Keith Show keeps rolling straight along. And I have some special prizes to send you via the good old U.S. mail if you'd like to support for a little bit more than $2 a month. Anyway, that's patreon.com/Nurse Keith. I appreciate you all so much. Thank you for listening, sharing, and supporting the show. The show notes are at nursekeith.com in the menu item labeled podcasts. And the show notes are also in any app where you happen to be listening, including Castro, Overcast, etc., etc. So please check out the show notes and any of the links that we share after our conversation here with Dr. Nadorf. So Joan Nadorf, it's so great to have you here. And we're going to talk about something that I think is pretty ubiquitous. And reading your book makes it clear just how common it is. So we all have these patients who we view as quote unquote good patients. And then we have the patients who we view as like bad patients or non-compliant patients or difficult patients. And you wrote a book, and it's a great book, and it is called Changing How We Think About Difficult Patients, A Guide for Physicians and Healthcare Professionals. So Dr. Nadorf, what was the first crystallizing moment that made you think, oh my gosh, I need to write a book because this is really an untenable situation and we need to change the way we think?
Hi, Keith. Thanks for having me. It's an interesting question that you're asking. And I would say that the impetus for it actually started out as a lecture. I came out of my emergency medicine residency. I trained in Philadelphia. And then I came to Inova Alexandria Hospital. It was called Alexandria Hospital in those days, right outside Washington, D.C., this great emergency department. And I was in a dream job. And many, many shifts, I would go home. And I would be a little bit miserable. And one of the things that I determined was making me unhappy was some interactions with patients and or their families that were not going well. So I decided to research that and look into it. And at the time, I was on the faculty at George Washington University in the emergency medicine residency department. And I offered this talk as part of the grand rounds, and I called it Dealing with Difficult Patients. And I came up with some really good ideas. I went over some of the literature that was available at the time. And this was a long time ago. It was about 30 years ago. And most of the literature that I found was in, not surprisingly, in psychiatric literature. psychiatrists had written it, because a lot of it had to do with people with personality disorders. And it was kind of unpopular to think that perhaps part of the reason that we were viewing people as not good patients, as difficult patients, had to do with the thoughts that the nurses and doctors were having about them. So I put that aside. I learned a lot of good things. I gave the talk to the residents. My director liked it so much. I gave it again the following year, and I put it away. And at the end, more towards the end of my career, when I retired from clinical medicine, I was doing some non-clinical work, and I started to lecture to emergency medicine residents and nurses. I got the idea, and a friend put this idea in my head, to write a book about it, because a lot of our colleagues are suffering. They have very strong ideas about the way they think things should go. The thoughts that we have about our patients, that they should be doing certain things, they should be following our plans, they should do exactly what they say, we should be compliant, as we use those terms in our profession, are really making us suffer. There's no way that people can be that way all the time. And if we kind of come to grips with that, and we can change the way we think, things will go much better for us. And not that we can think our way out of every single situation, but we can at least put things into perspective that, for the most part, a difficult interaction with a patient or their family only occurs two or three times per one of our shifts. And that isn't really very much. Most of our interactions with patients are lovely and satisfying, and we feel pretty good about them.
Right. And so you're really zeroing in on the way we think about our patients, because that impacts the way we treat them, the way we act in the relationship to them. And it can cloud, and I don't know if you could use the word sort of like pollute the relationship or the quality of the relationship. And you go over a lot, all of this in your book. You outline it all very, very clearly. So my first question for you is, what makes a quote unquote good patient?
Well, it is a very subjective definition, but I think most nurses and doctors would agree that we want our patients to be independent, self-sufficient, and mature individuals who are logical and rational in their thinking. We want them to follow our advice. We want them to make the plans and the follow-ups. And if we ask them not to bend their arm, because that's where the IV is, we'd like them to do that. So these are people who we think act the way we do and have the same kind of adherence to the rules, and just, you know, in general, think the way we do, which kind of gets us into trouble because, of course, our patients don't have the same understanding that we do. And they just don't think the way they do. They have a lot of competing narratives in their life. We just don't even know what's going on for them. So we have, over time, and we see this when we walk into the nurse's station or the break room, we've developed some really negative thoughts about our patients. And those people we have kind of labeled as bad patients, or we use that term difficult.
Mm-hmm. And you know how there's lots of talk of out in the worlds of healthcare and nursing, there's talk about incivility, bullying, you know, the ways in which we treat one another, you know, and even those little aggressions like eye rolling and things like that. But we can do that around patients as well. And we may not roll our eyes when we're in the room with the patient, but when we go into the break room and we're complaining and bitching and moaning about patients and rolling our eyes and calling them derogatory names, you know, how does that affect then what happens when we leave the break room and we go back to the emergency department, you know, to see patients, or we go back to the ICU? Like, what are some of the negative impacts on our behavior?
That is very, very important, because we can't just turn on and off those negative thoughts. When someone, say we're getting a report of a change of shift, And the nurse on the shift before you says, Mrs. Smith is a difficult patient. Well, there's something called confirmation bias. This is a way of thinking where we, and looking at the world, where we look to confirm thoughts that we already have or things that we already believe. So if we believe that this person is not compliant and is very argumentative, doesn't really want to do what we say, the next person cannot help but look for those things. And the person's behavior may be, 95% great and satisfactory. But those little aspects where they're negative or not compliant in some way, we focus on those. And then we get this narrative that they're not being helpful. They're actually working against us. Here I am. I'm, doing all the great nursing things I'm supposed to do, all the procedures, giving the instructions, and they're not listening. They're watching their television. They're looking at their phone. They're bending their arm. And those are the things that we're going to focus on. We're going to have negative feelings about them. And the other thing that it results in, if you have really negative feelings, you can't stand someone who you're with, for example, you just, and this is just human nature, and we're all humans, we want to spend the least amount of time with them as possible. We will not go back into their room and hold their hand and reassure them and see if they need a warm blanket or they really could use repositioning in the bed. If we view them as kind of vile and nasty, we just don't even want to be with them. And that is very important for us to kind of calm those thoughts and redirect them because that it really isn't being fair to them. They deserve a chance and they deserve to have you come back to them and do all the beautiful comforting that we would like to do if we have the time. And so these are some of the reasons why it's important to not kind of reinforce all the negative thinking that goes on in the break room. I think it has, almost infected our workplaces. Everybody kind of gets in the spirit of complaining. We have a natural negativity bias. Our cave people ancestors had to look out on the horizon and look for a bear or a tiger that was coming after us. So we're always on the look for things that are negative or something that can be wrong in the environment. So we come by it naturally. We're always looking for the negative or something can get messed up, something that's dirty, something that's going to contaminate our field. We're always on the lookout for those things. So we never even see the things that are going right. And it's really important for us to redirect our thoughts that way.
Mm-hmm. And I also think about, if we're constantly running negative thought patterns about our patients, about their families, and then we have negative thoughts about the administration and about this and that, then, it changes the tenor of our workday and it changes the way in which we think about what we do. And we start to, we can have anxiety on our way to work or just feel miserable. And then that misery is, misery loves company and it can be contagious. And so your book runs through so many different aspects of this, these processes, these thought processes, and the ways in which our relationships are formed and the ways in which we conduct ourselves in relationship to patients. And it is all about patients, isn't it? In the end, if there weren't any patients, we wouldn't have jobs. So this is important. In your book, you talk about so many different things that are fascinating to me. One thing that you wrote about was the four models of the physician-patient relationship. And I found that really interesting to read through that. It was on page 12, so it was early on in the book. I think it's chapter 2. And can we talk about those for a second?
Yeah, that discussion is lifted from a very famous article, and it's worth going back and looking at because they talk about these very traditional aspects, doctor-patient, nurse-patient relationship. At one time, and you can see how this would have started, the older males were the physicians. And they had the education. They knew the way things were supposed to be. And there was a very patriarchal approach. And so the kind of original doctor-patient relationship is called, you know, the patriarchal one, mm-hmm. in that the doctors knew, and doctors and nurses knew what's best for their patients, and we expect the patients to do them. So, like, kind of fast forward to 2024, our patients don't think that way. That isn't the way we really supposed to think. Our patients have every right to make decisions for themselves. That our patients have autonomy. They can make a competent individual can make decisions for themselves, and doctors and nurses can disagree with them, but they have to respect them. And what I think is incumbent upon the nurses and the physicians is to discuss the issues with their patients so they can find out what their patients want. Now, that is called more of a deliberative approach in the four the different models of the doctor-patient relationship. That would be the deliberative model. And for you to find out what your patients and their families want, you have to talk to them. Mm-hmm. That takes time. For a lot of doctors, they're being examined very closely on how much time they're spending with the doctors. The nurse have really long to-do lists of things that they have to do. And one of the things that gets short shrift is sitting with the patients and their families and finding out what they really want, from their treatment.
So true. Right. So that deliberative model is a little bit of a challenge if you only have 15 minutes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, what I think a lot of nurses and doctors are finding out, especially end of life type of issues, there may be some understanding with a patient, and the patient may have expressed to someone what they wanted. And then a family member comes in and like, well, wait a second, we got to do everything for grandma that we can do. And that might not have been what she wanted. So of course there are numerous ways to deal with this. And there may have to be more time spent with the family, more time spent documenting what the patient really wants before the end. And these are challenges for the nursing staff, the physician staff, our ancillary staff. That's why we have to use the whole team. Sometimes we can bring in palliative care people, hospice nurses, who are more of, this is more viewed as their role to get into what people really want, so you can honor those wishes.
Yeah, exactly. And then in the book, you also talk about the informative model, where the physician informs the patient about all these different aspects of their disease and what could be done. Then the patient chooses what they want to do. And you have the interpretive model, where the physician provides the information, but doesn't dictate to the patient, but just helps the patient determine what they want to do according to their volume, their values. But you say at the end of this section, you say that you think most physicians use the model that you call the maternalistic model with beneficent coercion. Could you explain what that means?
Well, first of all, of course, I view the maternal model because I am a mother.
Yeah.
And I am a female physician. So
yes.
I think about my patients the way in a very beneficent, that means, you know, I want what is best for them. I love them. And I would do for them what I would try to do for one of my children or someone in my family.
Yes.
And I think that in a lot of ways, patients appreciate that, because let's face it, the situations are so overwhelming. We're not always so good at bringing down our language to their level. You had Dr. Goldman on a few months ago, and he talked very eloquently about this, how we were not bringing our language down enough for people to understand what's going on. So they just want to be told, and I'm okay with this. They want to basically be told what to do. And it doesn't always work that way, but that is, I think, in the emergency department in particular, and that's, you know, my experience has all been there. because that's, I'm an emergency physician. That's where I've always practiced. There isn't much time to get into, you know, what would grandma have wanted? What do you want? What are all the alternatives? I try to give people some alternatives. What might happen if you're treated? What might happen if you're not treated? How much time you have to make this decision? And what you can do after you leave the emergency department. But it all takes time. And people are waiting. And as some people, as the patient in front of you gets better, someone even sicker is being brought in the back door. So it is a constant challenge. And this shared decision-making model is great, but we have to work at it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about solutions. We're going to talk about, you know, the ways in which we can change our thinking, because that's really what you're after here in this book, is like, how do we change the way we think about difficult patients? Because it can change the way in which we feel and think about our own work and the quality of our work and how much we, you know, enjoy what we do, and also outcomes for patients. So it has a very, I mean, it's a very pervasive impact, the way we think. And you present some ideas for how to do that. But before we take a break, I wanted to mention this aspect that you brought up in chapter 5, which is the four patient types identified by Dr. James Grove, who was a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General back in the, this was in the late 70s. And he wrote an article called Taking Care of the Hateful Patient. And it was a landmark paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. And you say how he was the first person to acknowledge on a worldwide platform, being the New England Journal of Medicine, that there are patients who kindle aversion, fear, despair, and downright malice in their doctors. And he characterized and classified these four different types of patients. And how do you feel about the way in which Dr. Grove went about this? Do you feel like it was helpful? And are these four types applicable? And was this landmark paper really something that helped to bring this conversation to the, you know, to the fore?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I do think that was really an important paper, because I think that at the time when it came out, it was one of the first times that people were actually discussing our relationship with patients and how some of the patients actually made the doctors and nurses feel. And it wasn't great. He used the term hateful. And those are his words, by the way. So when I quote him, and I wrote a piece for the Washington Post where I made reference to that, and people got really worked up about that term, that you shouldn't hate anybody. I'm like, but that was the term that he used. And I think he's trying to signal that the behavior was really unlikable. It was hateful. And you know, humans who are taking care of people, we have our emotions and we have our likes and dislikes too. And we feel this way about some of the patients. So what I think is really helpful about the four types, and they're stereotypes, mm-hmm. people don't always fit nicely into them.
No.
The first one is called dependent clingers. The second one he called entitled demanders. The third one are manipulative help rejectors. And the fourth one are self-destructive deniers. I talk about them in the book, and it is worth looking back at the original paper, because he goes into so much more depth about them. Mm-hmm. And I think what's useful in thinking about it this way is, first of all the doctors and nurses can think, oh, it's not just me thinking this way. This is kind of a universal thing. There are people out there who react in this certain way when they're in the medical system. And there's more to know about it. And what's interesting, since he's a psychiatrist, he kind of discusses things in terms of the underlying psychiatric problems and how insecure people are, and people are ext- extremely afraid of abandonment. And this underlies especially the first two, the dependent clinger and the entitled demander. The people who cling are very dependent, and they're really nice to the doctors and nurses, and they flatter them, and they bring them gifts mm-hmm. and flowers and mm-hmm. send pizza in and all this stuff. And they act like children. Then this is how they try to get what they want. But the people who are the entitled demanders, and boy, we see a lot of these people.
We do.
Because those are people who use intimidation, and they're impatient and arrogant and condescending to us. And they think they can bully us into getting what they want. And there's, I think, almost nothing worse than a patient or a family can come at a very proud doctor or nurse in that manner, because, you know, we didn't get to where we are by just being pushovers. We're pretty strong-willed and we have strong backbones, and we don't really like being told what to do. Mm-hmm. So, but those people are also very dependent. A lot of them have like narcissistic personality traits, and they don't understand why they're not being treated as if they're special. These are the people who come into triage or into the room in the ICU and announce right away that they're on the hospital board, you know, that they write for the local newspaper or whatever. And they're coming at you full bore with threats before you even have a chance to explain what's going on and to kind of calm everybody down. So I think it's really helpful to understand these people. The third group are the manipulative help rejectors, and mm-hmm. every sort of practice of nursing and medicine sees this. These are people who never seem to get better. The people who have possibly substance abuse issues, who never seem to be able to shake them, come in with substance abuse related pathology, like, you know, issues with their alcohol intake or drug use, or overeating. And it's very difficult to maintain like kind of clean thoughts about them, not to blame them, and not to get kind of aggressive or hostile to them, because they're coming at us a lot of time in those ways. And then the last category he talked about is the self-destructive people. I think maybe I just mentioned this, some alcoholics and drug users and smokers. You know, we can't, you know, our COPD patients who we pull through the worst infection or vent episode in the ICU, and we know they're going to go out and smoke again. We have to find some way to change our thoughts and be a little bit more accepting of them as they are, because if we're expecting them to change at this point, that and kind of hinging their changing on the way that we feel at work, or how we approach our day, things are never going to get better for us. We're going to be miserable.
True. So true. And I bet a lot of people listening are nodding their heads like, I've been there. So when we come back from the break, now that we've identified the problem and we've identified how our thoughts can impact our behavior and the way we think about our work and can even affect patient outcomes because we approach them differently and maybe don't spend as much time with them because they're just unpleasant and we want to limit our exposure. So there's, you know, wide, you know, just there's a wide girth of impact of the way we think about patients. So when we come back, I want to talk about how we can change that. And, you know, because that's really what you're after here. And I'd love to have you read a little bit from the book so people can hear it in your own voice. So hang in there with us. We'll be right back with the second half of episode 467 of the Nurse Key Show with doctor, author, and speaker, Joan Nador. And welcome back to the second half of the episode. We're here again with friend of the pod and my new friend and colleague, Dr. Joan Nadorf. And Joan, it's so great to have you here. And This is a very important conversation because, like I was saying before the break, it has far-reaching consequences, the way we think about our patients. And it can impact how we think about our work and our jobs. It can make us feel hesitant and anxious about even going to work at all. And it can also impact patient outcomes in ways that you and I talked about. So I would love to have you read a little excerpt from the book. It's always nice to have the listeners hear and a book in the author's voice. So do you have a little snippet you'd like to read for us?
There are two snippets. I'm going to read one from the beginning and kind of one closer to the end, because I think it'll help wrap things up.
Go for it.
And by the way, there is an Audible version available of this book, and it is not narrated by me. So now, you know, this, you can hear this in my sweet New Jersey accent.
Land of my birth, like gives me warm fuzzies. So you go for it.
Hey, this is from chapter one. It says, "We can't stand some of our patients. Every physician, nurse, EMT, respiratory therapist, and clinician of every specialty has mused about how much better their workplace would be if they did not have to deal with difficult patients or demanding families. What a delightful fantasy. We all know that sinking feeling we get when one particular name appears on our calendar or triage board in the emergency department. Some presenting problems fill us with dread and apprehension. For some, it is another senior citizen who feels weak and dizzy. For me, it's when the words nosebleed or fishbone stuck in the throat appears in the triage note. Feelings of inadequacy and futility always manage to rear their ugly heads. I've always had trouble with these situations before. What if I can't find that darn nose, that darn fishbone, or stop that stubborn bleed? Patients are problematic only when they evoke negative thoughts in the treating clinician, thoughts that create feelings of frustration, confusion, anxiety, sadness, and disgust. Those negative feelings can lead to undesirable actions such as arguing, snubbing, or prematurely discharging the patient. Those who entered the medical profession with the highest and noblest intentions do not want our actions to stem from feelings of anger, fear, and hatred. We are far better than that.
We are far better than that, but we often don't feel like we can get there. So I would love to have you read that other section too. Sounds like an important way to balance this out.
Now this is from chapter 17. Why can't all patients feel happy and grateful? What a lovely fantasy we have concocted for ourselves of our medical office or hospital fantasy land. When we think our interactions with patients should all be lovely and mutually beneficial, we will frequently be disappointed. We want them to follow the instruction guide so we get to feel better. Some people will refuse medications and leave against medical advice. Of course, they have the autonomy to do whatever they want. So we get disappointed or frustrated. No wonder so many of us are severely disillusioned and feeling exhausted at the end of our shifts. Periods of conflict and disagreement with colleagues, patients, and family members come up in every clinical workplace. Stop expecting your life or your job to feel good all the time. Half the time it will be happy and rewarding, and half the time it will feel terrible and depressing. When people invariably come at you with disapproval, anger, and defiance, don't be surprised. Be prepared. Nothing has gone wrong here. Your patient just might be exercising their autonomy. Some people will hold opinions that you do not share. They may offer you their thoughts in the form of insults, threats to report you to the State Board of Medicine or the local news outlets, or complaints to your supervisors. The venom in their words will feel threatening. Their insulting words may make it easy for you to have your own thoughts of self-doubt. Their actions may actually be physically threatening. So again, be prepared.
And when you speak to groups and you bring this kind of information forward, when people respond to your book, you know, whether it's a nurse, a physician, you know, a social worker, what do they say? Like, Are they nodding their head saying, yep, you're telling my story? And do they express hope that there's a way to change this based on what you're offering them? Or do they feel like this is just a done deal and the patients are just difficult?
Usually when I look around the room, everybody's shaking their head and nodding in agreement. Mm-hmm. And then I'd love for people to tell me their kind of juiciest stories, because this helps me kind of reframe things for them. And everybody kind of, well, you know, sometimes we have a good laugh, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. There is a little gallows humor in our profession.
There is.
And it's one of the ways that we let off steam. But without kind of mocking people or sounding really condescending, that helps to reframe our thoughts. So what I find, and I have tried to encourage people, at one group I talked to in California, there was a family practitioner who gave a really impassioned story about her difficulties with a patient who was so negative and never wanted to follow advice. And she felt so frustrated that she couldn't do more, even though, boy, she was trying a lot. And then finally found out when she went to, she actually went to the patient's funeral, and the patient's brother came to her and said, you know, he expressed to us how wonderful he thought your medical care was and how everyone in the office had tried to help him so much. And this helped reframe things for her. And I encouraged her to try to write that as a narrative medicine piece. And that was really hard for her to do. But that is one way to kind of come to grips with the kind of the situations that people are having, to discuss it with people, discuss it with your coworkers. Unfortunately, some of our talk in the break room and in the nurse's station kind of gets reinforcing. We kind of reinforce our negative thoughts about people. And at the very end, even if we come to the conclusion, they say, yeah, that is a really difficult situation, but we have to reframe it in the fact that this is only one of, you know, the 20 patients you saw on your shift today. Mm-hmm. And so that is really a very small percentage. Mostly everything went great. Little babies smiled at you. People thanked you. Everything was pretty much fine. And it helps, because what we know about everything in life, that there are going to be some tough times, and there are going to be some tough times at your shift at work. And things are usually going to get better.
Yes, that's very true. That's a good reframe. Now, in the book, you also mention something called the think, feel, act cycle. And in the context of that cycle, if you could explain it, how do we then manage our thoughts so that they don't become so pervasive that they're coloring everything, and we're, you know, we don't have rose-colored glasses on anymore. We have sort of like, we have, you know, glasses that distort the reality in front of us.
Yeah, it's very important. And this is part of the basis of the book, and which is that there is a situation or event or a circumstance in life. And a lot of this thinking comes from cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. The life coaches out in the world are using this and calling it the thought model. But there is a think, feel, act cycle. And when things happen in the world, in the context of this book, a patient is arriving through the doors of the medical office or the emergency department or the ICU, and it is a neutral event. That is, there is nothing inherently positive or negative about it until a clinician has a thought about it. And for example, one of the very, very common thoughts that we have in the emergency department is, this patient shouldn't be here. This is one of the most terrible thoughts that we could have, and we all have it. And we're fighting with reality, because the patient is here, and, you know, and where else should they be? We are the most prepared and empathetic and educated people to take care of their problem. They think it belongs in the emergency department that day, so that is where it's going to be. So in the think, feel, act cycle, there is an event or circumstance, and a clinician has a thought about it. A nurse or a doctor has thoughts. I think I can help this person. Oh no, I can't believe this guy is here again after drinking another pint of vodka. Whatever our thoughts are, those are going to determine our feelings or emotions that we have about the patient. So the emotions that we have, whether we're curious about what happened, whether we're disgusted, whether we like them, whether we don't like them, this is going to determine our actions. Now, actions in the medical setting are the labs that we order, the x-rays, whether they need a sonogram, what kind of procedures we do, how much time we're going to spend with them, or the things that we're not going to do for them. So this is very important to spend more time taking a history and physical, find out what really happened, and anything that deters us, any kind of negative feelings and say, I don't even want to be with this person because they're so nasty, or they smell bad, or I can't be there because they're, you know, kind of physically aggressive. We have to figure out a way to redirect our thoughts, because that determines what our results are. If we have, we're more likely to get better results with our patients if we're choosing the correct studies, actions, if we can start their IV, if we can get them to a point where they're taking the medications and starting to feel some of the beneficial effects. Because, you know, our object is to, at least in the emergency department, is to get them out of the emergency department, to dispose of them, to ever have people admitted or sent home. We want people to feel better. All of us do. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to have thoughts, to be thinking with more intention. And that's not to say, like you mentioned, I'm not saying put on rose-colored glasses. Sometimes we want to be sad that something terrible happened, or someone's really sick, or someone had a terrible accident. These are totally appropriate. I mean, we see some of the most dramatic and saddest things that are happening on a patient or a family's worst day. And sometimes we want to have a little cry with them and feel terrible. So that is totally appropriate. But we, in terms of some of the judgments we make about people, some negative judgments, we can clean that all up and be a little bit more curious, a little bit more empathetic. And we're going to talk about some of those ways we can get there a little bit later.
Yeah. So as a board certified emergency physician, I'm assuming that, you know, the frequent flyers are probably the ones that are the most challenging in many ways, because it's like, oh, Ed is here again, right? He's been here a million times, and there's a whole mythology built up around Ed and, you know, whatever his circumstance happens to be. And I can, you know, I've never worked in the ED, but I understand that challenge of patients who come in over and over and over again. So if I'm a nurse, I'm listening to the show, I'm listening to you, I'm going to read your book. What can a nurse start to do first, just to change how they personally think about their challenging patients? Is it a cognitive strategy? What is it that we have to do?
That's a great question. And it is important that we start right away, because that situation of the frequent flyer and just even using that term, such a minefield.
Yes.
That we're all stepping into, because I guarantee that one day Ed is going to walk in, not just with a hangover, but with a subarachnoid hemorrhage, yep, or a subdural hematoma.
Yeah.
And something that we are going to miss because we say, this is just like every other time he's been here. And that is, it's called anchoring bias or confirmation bias, that we think it's the same as before, and we don't look as if it's a new patient coming in, where we would go through all of our checklists and all of our beautiful protocols and make sure that we're not missing something. And we don't even look for those new things because we are so biased against them. And if one of those words appears, comes in our handoff between the shift, or God forbid, you know, triage note or something like that, it just colors everybody's perceptions that come afterward. So what I tell people to do to begin to change their thoughts is to ask better questions. And when a guy named Ed, who maybe drinks too much, comes in for the 10th time this month, I need to ask better questions. And like, who is Ed? Ed isn't just the town drunk. Ed is someone's father. Ed is someone's brother, or Ed is someone's son. That one way of reframing, that is not putting on rose-colored glasses. All those things are true. If we think about that person as someone's family member, or possibly how you would like your family member to be treated, for those of us who are parents, we think about that kind of unconditional love we have for our children and how we want them to be given the benefit of the doubt if they show up in your emergency department or your medical clinic. I'd like for us to be able to treat our patients that way. So what else could be true here? What else is true about this person in front of me? This is someone's mother, someone's aunt. This is possibly a veteran. This is a retired school teacher. These roles are really hard to see when someone is elderly. They haven't been doing these things for a while. They always act in a certain way. We really have to ask better questions. And another way to change the way we think and our judgments are to question ourselves and say, could I be wrong about this way that I'm thinking? And I think there's only one way to do something. We kind of fall into, I talk about this falling into all or nothing thinking. Could there be another way to solve this problem that isn't just my way? When the patient says they have to leave and take care of something, it's impossible for me to understand how important that is to them. And it's, in their mind, it's more important than staying in the hospital and getting that treatment. If I could understand that better, perhaps we could come up with a plan. Perhaps my way is not the only way. Perhaps there are actually 14 other ways, but I just can't see them because of my blinders. So these are some of the ways we can start to change the way we're thinking.
Those are good reframes. And in terms of reframing, what if you mentioned a handoff, right? So what if it's change of shift, right? It's, I don't know, it's 3 p.m. or 11 p.m. or whatever, and we're having a change of shift. And a nurse hands off to me, you know, a bunch of patients, and the nurse says, oh, you know, Ed's in bed 8, you know Ed, and, you know, he's just, you know, they might say he's just a frequent flyer, or Mr. Jones is here again, you know, and they roll their eyes. And you know, do we solely think, okay, so here I am getting this handoff. I am going to filter this so that I don't go in there just rolling my eyes, you know, mentally and emotionally, and approach him as if he's just, you know, like a bothersome gnat, right? Or do I also say something to the nurse doing the handoff so that I can make it clear that I'm not accepting this characterization? Like, how do you do that dance? And can you have an impact on the people, the other clinicians around you? Or is that a slippery slope?
I think that's a tough one, because I think that some of the kind of negative groupthink is so strong that for you to come in and say, oh, don't say that, he reminds me of my Uncle Harry, which you absolutely should do, because you want that person treated as well as your Uncle Harry. I think it's more that you should hear what that person says. I think a red flag should go up in your brain immediately and say, like, I'm going to try and go in and do, you know, a quick assessment as well as I can, as time allows, and see if that story may not be true. That's just a story that person's telling. So many of us see, and I'm sure in all different facets, especially with the medical record, the electronic medical record, some diagnosis or some words get stuck on in the first note, maybe from the emergency department, maybe from somewhere else, from outside, and it could be a totally wrong diagnosis or words that prejudice whoever comes behind. Someone will use the term, for example, drug seeking.
Oh, yes.
Okay. People who are in pain are looking for relief. There's nothing wrong with that. We have to figure out a way to address those issues without labeling people in this very negative way or just refusing them entirely. So I think it's important for people to hear those words. I don't think you can change your colleagues this way. If you want to suggest that you heard this really cool podcast and maybe people can get the book and have a little book club, mm-hmm. I'll even call in and zoom in on your book club if you want me to. So
yes.
It's worth it because I think, you know, we just have to let go of some of these thoughts a little bit to feel a lot better about things. Just thinking like, okay, yeah, this is one of those things today. Yeah, I knew everything wasn't going to go perfectly today. I mean, who really thinks that? I mean, would mm-hmm. we like it, everything to go perfectly today? Of course. But of course, the first thing, I noticed this even in myself when my doctor says, I want you to take this, some of the prescriptions we give to kids, parents to give to their kids, and we want them to take them four times a day. Come on.
Yeah, right.
I mean, not really. Is anyone ever get it that way? Mm-hmm. How can we find a way I wrote hundreds, perhaps thousands of prescriptions. I had my own child. I could not give him oral medication. As soon as something hit his soft palate, he mm-hmm. puked. And that's a problem. And I never even thought about it before. Mm-hmm. You know, the nurses just came in with those syringes and put it in their mouths. And I'm like, we're all done here. So
right.
there are ways that we have to change our thinking and we have to put ourselves in the shoes of our patients. They don't know why we're asking them to do things. Such an important part of the role of a nurse in education. This is why you have to take the medicine this many times a day to kind of keep the level of the medicine at a certain level in your body. The patients don't understand. The more explaining we could do, the better. And just realize it's not going to be 100% in terms of compliance, but we have to accept our patients the way they are. Mm-hmm. And trying to fight reality and hoping that they will change, it is just going to make us suffer.
Right. And I know what we can do. We can casually leave a copy of your book lying around the break room. There's one way we could do it. And the other way we could do it is give all of our clients a copy of your book for the holidays. So there's one intervention we could practice.
I've actually started, I've turned my attention a little bit to talking to patients and the public. Mm, now that this book is obvious, this book is for clinicians.
Yes, it is.
So I don't expect, you know, people in the public to pick it up and read it. Although I will tell you that some very lovely reviews online have come from people like teachers who have some of the same problems. They obviously have difficulties with students or parents, and it helps to be able to change the way we think about them so that they can deal with them because they're going to keep coming. It's not, you know, you're not going to have a perfect situation. And what I'm trying to tell patients, I don't say it this way because it sounds a little snarky, how not to be a difficult patient to your doctor or nurse. But so many of them come to me or have sent me comments, people send me emails and say, I never thought about it this way. You know, I am a really difficult patient and maybe they can't stand seeing me when I come in. And that's not to say that you can't bring up questions or raise issues that you disagree with your doctor or your nurse, but it has to be in a respectful manner. And there has to be some dialogue about it and just kind of questions and answers. And if they don't have time for it, then maybe reschedule another appointment so that we can talk about these things and come to some shared decision-making. So I call it how to become a smarter patient, but my, you know, in parentheses, it's how not to be a difficult patient.
Well, I'll have you on the show again when that book comes out, the companion book, which I think would be awesome. There was a book some years ago, I interviewed the author. I think it was called The Empowered Patient. And it was a really good book. And I've actually utilized some of it myself as a patient. And I think it was by Martine Ehrenclou, if I recall correctly. But I think your companion book is definitely, you know, I'm putting out the call for you to write the companion book.
Well, sometimes I stumbled into this, writing this book a little by accident. You know, someone suggested I do it, and I submitted it to a publisher through American Association for Physician Leadership and was offered a contract to have it published kind of right off the bat. So I didn't have to go through a lot of the suffering that people, potential authors go through. But the next book, if there is one, may deal with those issues. And it's kind of goes through the same think, feel, act cycle, because our, as a patient, and we're all patients at some time or another, of course I am too. Mm-hmm. We have some thoughts about how things should happen, how fast I should get better, what medication my doctor should prescribe for me. We have a lot of thoughts about that that don't serve us very well. And if we thought with more intention, if we kind of loosened up on that, you know, like my doctor should never be late, I shouldn't have to wait for 4 hours in the emergency department. Those are not helpful thoughts. And if we can loosen those up and understand it better, it doesn't mean that you're still not going to have to wait for 4 or 6 or 8 hours, but maybe perhaps you'll understand it better.
Yeah. Well, Joan, this is a really important book. I recommend everyone listening to buy a copy. It's called Changing How We Think About Difficult Patients, A Guide for Physicians and Healthcare Professionals by Dr. Joan Nadorf. And people can find you by going to drjoannadorf.com. That's D-R, Joan, J-O-A-N, and then Nadorf, N-A-I-D-O-R-F.com. And they can also find you on the platform formerly known as Twitter. And you are at Joan Nadorf on that platform, which we guess we now call X for better or worse. And I can't thank you enough for being here. The links will be in the show notes so people can find you and find the book and buy it from your website or on Amazon. And thank you so much for being here. This is a really important conversation. And before we go, I have 4 really quick lightning round questions to ask you before we close that I ask all my guests. Are you game for a quick lightning round?
Sure.
Okay. And in the interest of time, they'll have to be fairly concise. But my first question is, how do you define success personally or professionally?
I feel successful when I feel like I've connected with people and have a good feeling about how those interactions went at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. You're a relational person. Okay. Speaking of relationships, the second question is, could you name or describe someone who's inspired you in the course of your life? They could be living or dead, a very famous person, or someone from your personal life?
One famous person who's inspired me, I wrote a little essay about it, was Billie Jean King. She was a person who kind of tilted up against some of the power structures of her day in sports. And I played sports a lot when I was young. She came out with a magazine when I was in high school. And one of the first things I did with my own money was to buy a subscription to that magazine. And although I don't have the skills to be a professional tennis player, I kind of used that application to go through some of the hard times on the way to becoming a physician. And they make it really hard for people, just academically, and throw a lot of roadblocks at us. And anybody who's made it to be a physician or nurse in today's world knows what I'm talking about. So she is one of those people who I admire greatly.
She really is. And I remember watching the famous match between her and Bobby Riggs when I was a child, because I was a tennis player. My dad and I used to play a lot of tennis, so I remember very clearly. So yeah, Billie Jean King. Okay, third question. Is there a book or a movie, not necessarily an absolute favorite, that's had an impact on either the way you think, the way you live your life, the way you approach your work or relationships, just anything that comes to mind that holds special meaning for you?
Well, I read and review books for the DO magazine.
Oh.
So I read and review a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
And I, because of my work in this field, and I've kind of made it my little second act mission to get doctors and nurses to kind of deal with this issue, because I think they're making themselves suffer way too much. We have a lot of hard things in our profession.
We
don't need to suffer so much about this. And I'm not saying that this is the magical answer to burnout, but if we could kind of fix this one issue, things would get a lot better. And then we can kind of deal with the other issues and supplies and administration and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I think is so useful for young physicians and nurses to learn more about how patients think is to read patient memoirs. And I would say one of the best ones that I've read in the last few years is called In Shock by Dr. Rana Audish. She is a critical care doctor in Detroit. And I think her book came out about 4 or 5 years ago. It talks about events that happened in her life maybe 15 years ago when she was pregnant with her first child. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but it is an eye-opening account of what it was like for a person to be admitted to her own intensive care unit. I mean, these were literally, she like made perhaps the week before doing rounds with these doctors and nurses and med students. And she saw the best and the worst. And I'm going to say there was a lot of the worst. So this is a wonderful book. She's very talented. And I recommend everybody check that out.
Wow. So In Shock.
In Shock.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. Last question. If you, Dr. Joan Nadorf, were named Queen of the World tomorrow, and you had ultimate power to do everything you wanted to do, what would be your first act as queen?
Wow, I don't know if I can answer that one quickly. They would take, I would kind of ask people to try and listen to each other a little more carefully without forming rash judgments. Because I think on every level right now in our medical care, in our politics, in the way we treat one another, there's a little bit too much harsh judgment and not enough understanding.
Mm, that's good. Yeah. See, that goes back to this, you're highly relational, and communication and the way we think are so important to you. And that comes through in actually all of your responses here. So that's really wonderful. And again, people can go to Dr. Joan Nadorf, Dr. Joan Nadorf, NAIDORF.com. The link will be in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed this episode with Dr. Joan Nadorf. And Joan, thank you so much for being here. I hope everyone goes out and buys the book. And if anyone out there would like holistic career coaching to elevate their career, check out nursekeith.com, mention the show, and get 10% off your first coaching package. And you become a patron at patreon.com/nursekeith, or just share the show with anyone with whom you think would enjoy it or get something out of it. We are proud members of the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com, and we are adroitly produced by Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting. And Joan, thank you so much for being here. You're so wonderful, and this is a very important book, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Keith. I was so happy to spend a little time and try to explain some of these very important ideas to your listeners.
Thank you so much. And before we say goodbye, I'd like to leave you all with this quote by Helen Keller. The best and most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or even touched. They must be felt with the heart. Be well, dig deep, seek joy, keep in touch. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the inimitable Dr. Joan Nadorf saying arrivederci from
sunny Alexandria, Virginia.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Nadorf. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you on the proverbial flip side.